CliffCentral.com.
That one goes out to the Pietermaritzburg Girls High School. Don't call me Kafir. Come on, guys. In this day and age, are we still having this conversation? We once did a show on this. We once had an entire discussion about, are you raising racists? Are you raising racists? We discussed it, and a lot of people were like, no, of course I'm not raising a racist. But now look, these are high school kids who are using the same language of the oppressor against one another. We have a long way to go. Not acceptable. So that is a message to to the Pietermaritzburg Girls High. Deal with it, sort it out. We don't want this nonsense in our country. Not anymore. But anyway, good morning. This is Frankly Speaking. This is Rory. Today I'm flying kind of solo. My partner in crime, Andrew, is out and about. But we've got quite a sensitive topic, and it's much too much for one guy to handle. So we didn't just need reinforcement. We needed female reinforcement, and not just female reinforcement, but the Mimi Magic to reinforce us in studio. Joining us this morning as co-guest host is Miss Mimi Kalinda. Good morning, Mimi.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Rory.
Yeah,
Mimi. Was wondering when you're going to invite me.
No. This invite is long overdue.
Yes.
And it's the perfect time to speak to you, because today's show is Frankly Speaking, is the African passport going to make us all poor? And for those that don't know, we've got, there's been an African passport introduced, or that is in the process of being introduced, which basically would allow all Africans to travel without the need for visas between the different African countries. Mimi, can you just introduce yourself so everyone understands who you are and why, what you have to do with this topic?
Sure. So I run a company called Africa Communications Group. And one of the things that we're concerned with at the moment is communicating around the work of the African Union reforms. Now, when you say African Union, people have very strong opinions or no opinion at all. But essentially, the African Union is reforming in a number of different ways. And one of the ways is to push for the one African passport, to make sure that we all have one passport. Now, this does not exclude the fact that we'll still have our own country's passports. But the goal is to have, by 2020, have put in the infrastructure necessary in each country for us to be able to travel across borders without necessarily the need for visas, which I think would be a fantastic idea. So this, my role around this is really to communicate about this, to educate people around the AU reforms and the implementations of these reforms that are coming up.
Okay, and now we're going to speak about the African, the integration of the rest of the continent. You say it sounds like a good idea.
Yes.
That we're going to have almost a borderless Africa. Why is this such a good idea? I mean, we've lived with borders for all of our lives. Why is it a good idea?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think that the issue is, should we have a united Africa? I think the issue is, how do we have a united Africa? What are the implications at country level? Because, you know, my three reasons really for having this are, one, we need to start being taken more seriously as a world power. And the only way we can do that is if we're united politically and economically. The second question I would pose is, does any African country have the economic and political muscle to attain first world status alone? If the answer is no, then we need to unite. And the third one is to have unbridled independence and peace in pursuing Africa's development goals. we have to be united. I mean, this has happened. I don't even understand why this is a question. I mean, we saw this happen. You know, the Scotland and the UK and England, united to make Great Britain. You know, China had to go through a civil war, you know, to become the People's Republic of China. The United States had to go through a civil war to become the United States. And yes, it's a painful process. And the reason I speak about those examples is because it's a painful process. But the end result and the end goal is what we need to achieve, and it will be beneficial for all of us.
So you raised international examples, and I think that's quite interesting, because we're in a state of probably sort of a weird change in the world right now, where we're seeing in the Western world a few countries, some of the larger economies, saying, you know what? This thing of integration is actually not a good idea. The United States is closing borders. We're seeing Brexit happen. What do Africans know that the rest of the world that has actually tried this seems to not know? Are we jumping onto the bandwagon a little bit too late?
I don't think that it's too late. I think the time is perfect. You know, I think that the fact that, you know, people are talking about closing borders, etc., you know, of course, you know, we've come to, certain countries have come to, you know, a geopolitical step in their development where perhaps closing borders make sense. In Africa's case, we haven't even tried, you know, so the status quo is clearly not working for us. So, you know, my position is, you know, to have something that you've never had, you have to do something you've never done.
Okay, so that's a great opening shot, Mimi. Let's bring somebody else into this conversation. We've got George Ndirangu calling, who's joining us. George, good morning.
Good morning.
So George is in Kigali in Rwanda. So we're trying to go for a, and Mimi, you are, if we said where you're from, where would you say?
I'm from Congo, DRC, Rwanda, grew up in South Africa.
There we go. So we're Pan-African today in studio, and I'm just South African, so there we go. George, thank you for joining us, man. We're discussing whether the African passport is going to make us all poor. Now, the premise of this is that integration, if you look at the discussions in at least around Brexit and so on, you're seeing two concerns. So the first one is, will it make the richer countries poorer in the sense that you're going to see an influx of people to these countries, thereby placing a lot of pressure on the public infrastructure there and so on, and in the long term probably resulting in GDP per capita declines. On the flip side of that, is it going to make poorer countries as well poorer, because it allows richer countries to take the cream of the talent crop and cause a brain drain in those countries in order to benefit their brain gain. So how do we justify this? You work within the economic realm as a reporter and so on. How is this justified economically? We hear the philosophical and the political, but economically, is there justification?
Yes, there is justification. So the economics are simple, and I want to ask us to look at the big picture for a moment. So if you look at South Africa's economy as an example, it's about $400 billion in GDP. Its rate of growth is very slow. In fact, we have a problem as announced yesterday, or as we found out yesterday. And the cure and solution to that problem has to do with access to markets and leveraging the strength of one of the economies, for example, South Africa. So integration and bringing the continent together for South Africa is a win-win, because South Africa is able to expand and grow and have markets for its products. If you look at another country that is poor, I'm using your example of a wealthy and poor country on the continent. If you look at a small country like Malawi, I don't think that they would suffer necessarily from a brain drain. If anything, they would gain from an investment in their local market by expansion of the continent and access to each other's market. There are naysayers out there who are trying to build a narrative that says that integration is going to be destructive, as witnessed in Europe, and people are pulling out right now. But as my colleague Mimi said, where we sit, we are in the best opportunity to be able to build a consolidated market. If you look at China, for example, and China's size of the economy, the sheer size of the economy gives them some leverage over the global economy. But African economies are disintegrated, so they don't have any leverage over the global economy. If an investor is coming into Africa and wants to invest, they have to look at an isolated middle-class strata in different smaller markets, whereas if they were looking at a consolidated market, the volume of investment would be higher.
Mm.
And then lastly, the opportunities are not all in Johannesburg or Cape Town or Nairobi or Accra. The opportunities actually sit in some of the smaller underdeveloped cities because the opportunities to develop those cities. So an engineer doesn't have to sit in Cape Town for a lifestyle only. An engineer can actually build a new lifestyle in a smaller city, thereby creating a successful economy in that smaller city.
But is it easier said than done? This idea that we could live in an integrated continent. It seems we just can't, even just the African Union itself, never mind. So this is just a group of diplomats who are supposed to try and find a cohesive way of working together. They're struggling. How do we make entire populations begin to see the benefit of integrating?
And let me just jump in here, Rory, and just say that, just a quick correction. This is George Chibosiwe.
Is this George Chibosiwe?
Yes, and he is the founder of the African Democratic Institute and working very closely with us on the African Union reforms as well.
George.
Hi, George.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, so how do we then deal with integration at a population level and even at an economic level when our own diplomats who are supposed to at least be driving some sort of cohesion can't seem to... I mean, we've got the AU reforms now as a means of trying to reform this institution, which has been struggling over many, many years to make any meaningful impact. How do we do that to the both of you?
Well, I think reform is always hard. Change is a very complex thing. It's not an easy thing to do. But it's necessary at this point. And never before in history have we ever had an opportunity better to integrate the African economies and the African people in particular. I think the starting point is to be able to get our own people to think about an integrated continent and the benefits of that. The second part is to see our common heritage, where we've come from in history, how we end up on the same continent together, and we will be on this continent till the end of life. So it's much better for us to cooperate, collaborate, and see the similarities in our cultures and integrate those first. And so the first step is that at a national level, I think it's important for each of our sub-economies to have an understanding of the value of coming together. And I think the narrative of coming together is successful in many aspects of our lives.
Mm.
That's the first part. Then the second part is to then say, well, how do we drive our own ideas at a policy level to align with what the people understand unity to be?
But Mimi raised the fact that China had to go through a civil war, the U.S. had to go through a civil war. Can this happen voluntarily, or Mimi, should we take up arms and force this thing to happen?
Not necessarily. I think that, you know, quite frankly, I do believe, and, you know, I stand corrected, but that the majority of Africans, you know, see unity as a plus. You know, I don't think, like I said at the beginning, I don't think that uniting is really the issue or the question here. I think the how and how we make sure that the implications are positive for all of us, that's really the question.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I'd like to touch on is really, you know, something that's come up quite a lot when we talk about uniting Africa is, you know, quote unquote, independence from the West.
Mm.
What does that actually mean? You know, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that, George. And you know, I was reading a quote from Machiavelli this morning saying, you know, have them by the balls and their hearts and minds will follow. So do our leaders need to have the teeth that are strong enough to bite off Western teeth, Western fists off our balls, you know, not to be crude,
yeah.
But you
no,
know,
to be crude.
Yeah, no, to be crude.
To be crude.
But, you know, where do we stand on this whole independence debate? And is it really a thing?
I agree with you, Mimi. I mean, the truth is independence has to do with controlling our own destiny in terms of the programs that we choose to implement for ourselves and the vision that we carry for Africa. The vision of uniting Africa, first of all, starts with being able to finance an integrated process. We have the African Union, for example, which largely depends on donor aid and funds for them to implement their program. We have member countries not fully committing themselves to financing the administration of the African Union itself. And then we have peacekeeping missions, which they're doing successfully as African Union or as Africa, but we are not financing our own. So the first is that we need to finance our own. That's the first step of releasing ourselves from the clutch of the West. The second is we need to get our own citizens to see direct benefits of what that can bring. So, for example, an African Union passport, which will be launched at the end of this year, is one step in that direction. What it does is it means when I land in any country, I don't have any challenges whatsoever with being allowed to enter the country. Of course, I have to meet the immigration requirements of that country. And to clear the air, I think people think that when you have an African Union passport, then the whole continent will come to Joburg or will go to Nairobi. It's not like that. It's simply integrated in the sense that you have a database that gives you access to every African citizen in a consolidated way, and you are able to access and travel to each other's markets without any challenges. That opens up trade, actually. It doesn't close up trade.
Yeah, because I think when we talk about economic integration and, like you said, people coming to Joburg, Nairobi, Accra, etc., what we forget is that an integrated region economically also makes the poorer countries stronger. So therefore, people don't necessarily want to leave their countries. You know, so you actually
reduce. I hear you guys saying this will, and philosophically, you can't disagree. If you're a progressive thinking African about integration, but how help me to see how the ability of somebody who is in Mali being able to more easily access opportunities in South Africa is going to be good for Mali, because it means that South Africa is able to monopolize great talent while Mali loses some of its great talent. So in which ways are we? Is this going to ensure that the poorer countries don't become poorer, while the richer countries just continue to monopolize all of the best talent? George?
Well, that presupposes that all the opportunities are in South Africa. That the opportunities actually sometimes are in Mali. Just that the Mali citizen may not be able to access those opportunities because we're not holding each other to the same standard.
Sure.
And let me give you a very practical example that is being implemented right now. Regional integration begins with being able to consolidate our markets in a regional sense. And I think you can see that the continent has made a lot of progress in that area. East Africa, for example, is now at that consolidated economic point and will soon be really at the peak of being able to trade right across without any issues. The smaller countries there, like Burundi, are beginning to benefit from that. So you don't have every Burundian going to Nairobi or going to Kigali or going to Addis Ababa. What you actually have is business people coming out of Nairobi and beginning to set up shop and partner with their colleagues in Burundi and actually start a business that employs people. Now, expecting this to just be uniform change at the same pace coming from a different base, I think would not work. What it is you will get gradual change at different rates depending on the level of economic investment that has taken place in that specific country. So that's the first aspect. The second aspect then is, if you think about economies that want to grow, if you think about an economy like South Africa that is semi-industrialized and has some level of infrastructure, the room for growth exists in the neighboring country. The market for the product exists in the neighboring countries, but it doesn't mean that you're just dumping products there. It's trade. There are things there that we need here in South Africa. So it is down to understanding the economics of integration.
Yeah.
And beginning to get our member countries to understand why each country stands off better when they integrate and connect to each other.
Mimi, you run a Pan-African business. What are some of the challenges that you face trying to run a Pan-African business that you feel that an Africa passport will just do away with?
Well, I think, first of all, just travel. You know, traveling for me from one country to the next, I think, you know, going from Johannesburg to Dakar, for example, you know, if you're lucky, you'll find a straight flight. Otherwise, you fly through Paris to get to Dakar, which is absolutely ridiculous.
That's crazy.
That's the first thing. The second thing is obviously visas are a huge issue. I mean, getting a visa to Nigeria, you know, is a process that takes, you know, a couple of days, up to 2 weeks sometimes, and it's very expensive. So, you know, which leaves me really dependent on working with affiliates and partners in each one of these countries and relying on other people to be able to execute on the ground, and finding it very, very, really increases the cost of business. And then I think also the second thing is just being able to send money across borders, you know, so paying you know, my people in Accra or paying my people in Guinea, you know, is quite a challenge in terms of money transfers, etc. So, you know, having one African passport and having, you know, being able to facilitate that process for my business would be hugely beneficial.
What do we do about the reason why we've got visas in the first place? So the reason why it takes so long to get a Nigerian visa, I imagine that they justify it as for security, for political stability, for all sorts of things. How would we then deal with those issues? Because those issues wouldn't necessarily go away, would they, George?
No, they wouldn't go away. In fact, if I could quickly add to what Mimi said, The other thing you get from an African passport traveling around Africa is just dignity. Standing at a line trying to get a visa to another African country.
100%. Mm.
When an American can walk in and pay their visa fee and go past me and I'm still 1 hour in the queue, doesn't make
crazy,
sense if I'm an African.
Yeah, and so to give you a very, very, you know, personal example, I have both a DRC passport and an American passport. When I travel across Africa, I use my American passport.
It's easier.
You know, like George said,
it's a more dignified
process. I don't have to stand in lines forever and people look at you different. Wow. So going back to the issue of narrative that you and I have spoken about so many times, it's a thing. So
you have to change your identity in order to be acceptable on your own continent. Jeepers.
Including in the DRC, by the way.
Jeepers. The accent doesn't hurt either, does it?
No.
but also, coming back to your point about visas, the way we fix that is really simple. The reason why you have a visa is because of two reasons. The first one is the security issue and controlling and being able to understand who comes in and out of the country, which is justified for every country that is a sovereign, right? But the second reason why you need a visa is actually, to be honest, reciprocity. So some countries, for example, in their bilateral agreement, don't actually have a visa. They've eliminated visas because they trust each other. Once there's a bit of acrimony between two countries, then the visa applies. I apply a visa in South Africa. Nigeria will also say South Africans, when they come here, must have a visa. So the way you deal with that is, first of all, establishing the levels of trust at a regional block level. Because if there is that level of trust, there is no need for any tiff to exist between, for example, South Africa and Zimbabwe or Zimbabwe and Botswana. Essentially, you've solved what is a foreign policy issue by how you've brought them together in a consolidated pool. The second one is then responding to each country's concerns, which is security concerns. South Africa, for example, would have a problem with immigration that is unchecked and people are just coming in and out without a proper system. So it means you're actually taking South Africa's immigration standard, which is very high, and making it the regional standard. Once it becomes the regional standard, we have common agreement in terms of how we immigrate and move around each of our countries. So it actually makes the entire region better off, because we all have to upgrade to a particular level and hold ourselves accountable to that level. And over time, the visa disappears.
Yeah, George, and you know, I think that this conversation sometimes gets really, really high level. And if we had to bring it down to, you know, obviously, you know of the issues in South Africa around xenophobia, you know, which are not particular to South Africa, I might just add. But, you know, when you talk to that person who says, I don't want foreigners coming into my country, et cetera, and the whole narrative around xenophobia. How do we start to answer the question, you know, how do we manage that? How do we manage that conversation at a very basic level?
Yeah, because he's not seeing a person coming in to take the African opportunity. He's saying, this guy's taking my job.
That's right.
Yeah, well, the reason why he's saying this guy's going to take my job is because we haven't taken our people to reimagining what jobs will look like in the future. And we haven't thought about the value of the job and what an individual gets from it. I can tell you the following in terms of just global economics and history itself. Those economies that actually open themselves up to new ideas and new people from new places effectively begin to generate the IP for whatever will conquer the world in that period. And I think the example of the United States is very practical. Closed borders, in my view, and I think history has proven, makes it difficult for patents of some of the biggest things to exist in an economy of a closed border.
But George, let me jump in there, because you're speaking to people who have the luxury of years to think about the future and so on. There's a person who is just thinking about his next meal. For him, he doesn't have the luxury of thinking, international patents, the future of work, and so on. So for that guy who's saying, you know what, I had this job, and now it's now somebody who has come in and is asking for less, and now I don't have a job. How do you speak to him? Because he's not going to be find it appealing to say, well, let's think about the greater good, so to speak.
Oh, no, I hear what you're saying. So that particular citizen, I think, exists in a particular place where the job that they're doing is being downgraded, as you say, in terms of the rates that they can earn, and therefore someone else takes the job. So that's a problem of skilling, right? It's a problem of what that national economy has done for the level of skill that this person needs to get a job higher up. So the first step of it is, if you look at the statistics, and I think so the Statistician General released this statistics a few weeks ago, the first myth that's out there is that foreigners come and displace locals and take their jobs. And that's actually a myth. that doesn't happen, particularly in a country like South Africa. What happens is that the foreigner comes and is willing to take the lower end job for a lower salary.
Mm.
And the standard of living of the local is of the higher end job for a slightly higher salary. So what the frustration comes in the skilling. And the Minister of Home Affairs in South Africa, the former minister, now Minister of Finance, when he dealt with this issue, was talking about what investment a country like South Africa would have to make for it to continue to lift the standard of living of its people and skill them for the jobs that its economy can create at a higher level. So it's a question of education and getting people to understand what happens in the job market and how is it happening. Because myths are created and then lead to things like xenophobia. But by every government's admission, the foreigner actually comes in to create jobs. He creates a smaller job, but down the chain. He's not creating it up the chain. And so that's why its value is not accruing to the local.
And that's a really interesting conversation. Maybe we should pick up on it at some point.
Mm.
But I think one of the things that I would add to that as well is to say that, you know, unity of Africa is not necessarily the climax of Africa's achievement. It's actually the start of our development and progress. So when you start to look at it like that, and of course, you know, every journey has its own sacrifices. And
maybe that is controversial. Okay, finish your thought.
Every journey has its own sacrifices.
So let's sacrifice
really,
these poor people and their jobs.
No, not necessarily. I didn't even say that. Don't even go there. But what I'm saying is there are going to be sacrifices, whether it's politically, economically, etc. And we have to be willing to make those sacrifices for generations to come.
All right, George, last thought on this.
Okay, cool. So to add to that, I would say the following. One is that some economies are ready for what those future jobs will look like, and they will create those future jobs. There's a statistic I came across. If you think about every child who's in grade 7 right now across the continent, the job that they are going to occupy is mostly uninvented at the moment because of the rates of change that we have to cope with.
Yeah.
So it's not a situation of all of us are going to try and do the very same thing. So it's helping young people reimagine what that future looks like and thinking about solving problems and the needs that they can respond to. That is where we solve it at source. When we try to solve it at the level of George, who now educated for an old industrializing world,
yeah,
when the world is globalized, it's a very, very different conversation. And so we should take that approach and see integration in that light.
Fantastic. George, thank you so much for joining us. Interesting, provocative statements there. I think we need you in studio so we can punch you in the face for some of the comments that you just made. But thanks a lot for joining us, George.
Thanks, George.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
So we obviously have a Pan-African listenership as well. And some clown from Nigeria has decided to send a message. Says, Rory, the issue not be just job or even babes. I'm told our South African brothers are also worried we're taking their babes. So
think about this. If we're united as a continent and you can travel to any corner of this continent, then you have more babes.
You know,
more options.
You're going to so get me into trouble. When Andrew comes back, he's going to say that I became a chauvinist in the space of one show. But Mimi, you are tasked with communicating.
Yes.
And it sounds like a lot of this is a communication problem. So how would you, I'm not convinced about George's proposal around how we communicate, how we communicate with people who live for the next hour, mm. and try and present with them with a proposal that is years and so on. Look forward, look into the future. How do we do it? You're the communication professional. How in the world are we going to convince people who live from hour to hour to say, you know what, this is good. Having South Africans come in and take your job is good for the greater good and for yourself.
I do think, you know, I do think there's value in what George said around, busting the myth of, you know, unemployment and foreigners coming in and taking jobs, etc. I do think that talking, you know, taking this high level conversation and bringing it down to, I hate the term, but the layman's voice, you know, for them to be able to understand what we're talking about, is to say, you know, number one, foreigners are not taking your jobs. This is actually what's happening. The second thing is, how do we create more jobs? Is an integrated, more united Africa going to create more job opportunities so that we can enlarge the pool of opportunities for all concerned? And I think once you start to go down those avenues in terms of narrative, then you have people's attention, because it's not necessarily about that one specific job. It's that I can't find a job. So can we create more jobs with this proposal? And if so, how does everybody benefit?
And isn't that the challenge? The people who are most mobile are the people who've got the money to move around and take advantage of the opportunities, while those that don't have the economic muscle won't be able to go and pursue that job in Kenya or so on, because they're stuck. They don't have money for the next meal, let alone a bus to the next country. So how do we then make it easier in terms of mobility as well? What are some of the plans there?
So, you know, I think I'll go back to what I said earlier, which is that the integration of Africa, the economic integration of the continent, does not just benefit. I think we're getting very much stuck in this will benefit richer countries and poorer countries will become poorer. The point is to bring everybody up to approximately the same level, or to attempt to do that. So if poorer countries become stronger economically, then obviously we have, you know, then again, going back to the whole issue of migration, why would a person from Malawi leave Malawi when they have opportunities there similar to the ones they would get in South Africa, to come to South Africa for a job? They could just stay in Malawi. And that solves the South African person's problem of a foreigner coming into the country and taking their jobs. So
what are some of the most ignorant, and I'm sure I've already asked some of those questions, some of the most ignorant questions and thoughts that have been shared as you've been contemplating and trying to communicate this message? What are some of the more ignorant things that people are saying that you're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe? Because that then demonstrates to you where the minds of people are at the moment, and where you need to start the conversation, right?
Yeah.
Which is the thing I'm challenging you about, is that you're starting the conversation from the point of a person who has evolved. But there are a lot of us who are still sitting here who still need to undergo that evolution. What are some of those ignorant statements that demonstrate that we still have far to go?
Well, I think going back to our lovely Nigerian friend who sent a message, I think, you know, people coming into the country and taking our girls is one of the statements, that we hear quite a lot. I think, you know, those interpersonal relationships, you know, and, you know, Nigerians are here, you know, too many of them, they're selling drugs, etc. The stereotypical stuff that you hear all the time. Those are the most ignorant, obviously, not based on facts, not based on research or anything like that. And I think, again, the solution is to take this high level message and bring it down to, bring it down to the ordinary African's understanding of things, and say, you know, let's just put girls aside for a minute and talk about how this is going to be good for your economic emancipation.
And how is the rest of the world seeing this? Have there been engagements with other parts of the world, the European Union, the US, the Eastern countries around this? Are they not threatened by this? Because I can imagine it's easier to deal with us divided rather than united.
Of course.
Are they even interfering to try and make sure this doesn't happen?
Well, it really depends on who you're talking about. I think that the whole unity of Africa thing has the potential to be a threat, absolutely, when you talk about the West. Specifically, you know, one of the reforms that, you know, we're talking about for the African Union, which is independence, economic independence. So when you start talking about a free trade zone, what does that look like for the rest of the world? How do they start interacting with us at that level? That's posed some challenges from a number of quarters. But, ultimately, we need to stay focused on the goal. You're not going to please everybody. At the moment, the way things are, when the West sneezes, Africa catches a cold, and we need to decide whether that's the route that we need to carry on or to change.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so who are the most supportive of this in outside countries?
It's a number. Well, let's not delve into naming and
name
shaming.
And shame. Name, this
no
is frankly
naming
speaking.
And shaming.
Mimi, this is frankly speaking. Speak frankly.
There are a number of supportive economies out there, and I think that we'll talk about it more.
Where are we going to talk about it more?
After the show.
This is where we're talking about it more.
After the show.
Let's look at, we're struggling to get George in from Rwanda. I wanted to speak to him about the economic implications, but 55% of African nations require a visa for the average African to travel into them.
Mm-hmm.
25% of the rest allow for visa on arrival, and 20% allow Africans to travel visa free.
Yes.
I'm curious, if we mapped this against GDP, are the most prosperous African nations also the ones that are most open, does that not translate? Because somebody will say, yeah, but you're saying this, but if we look right now, the most prosperous nations are actually a lot more closed off than those nations that are supposedly more open.
Well, let's look at some countries that you can travel to visa-free at the moment. Mm. Rwanda is one of them, or at least visa on arrival. Let's focus on visa on arrival. Rwanda is one of them. Senegal is one. Ghana is also one of them. So are they necessarily the most prosperous countries? Not necessarily. I think they're the most progressive countries in terms of, both from a leadership standpoint, but also from, a foresight, looking into the future and how are we going to benefit both our economies, and become integrated as part of the continent. So not necessarily. Progressive does not equal visa-free.
And what do you, so you have this job, it's an everyday job, you spend time with Kagame, how is it that he has managed, at least under his leadership, it seems like this is really getting wheels. What have been the major changes that have happened that have gotten us this far, and what is it going to take to sustain this momentum? Apparently, by according to Vision Agenda 2063, we're supposed to be visa-free by 2018. That's next year.
Yes.
How far are we in achieving this? Is it going to happen, and what is it going to take to maintain that momentum?
So when you look at the African Union reforms, I think the goal to become visa-free, or at least the implementation of this one passport reform at a country level, is supposed to reflect by 2020. Mm-hmm. So it's a process, because like I said, from a country level, you have to start building the infrastructure to be able to implement this change. And I think, let me also point out that the African Union has been through many recommendations for reform over the years.
Mm.
I think what makes this different, and this is perhaps an issue that we can touch on, is leadership. You know, when you have leadership that is leading a reform process, but then also at a country level willing to implement, then things start to move. And that's why I was saying, it was a pretty crude comment, earlier when I talked about Machiavelli, but it really is all about an issue of leadership. Do we have leaders who are willing to free themselves from the chains of the Western economic blocks, etc., and really focus on the developmental issues that affect their countries and their people?
Well, you said free themselves from being grabbed by the nuts. Let's go back to the crude thing that you said.
By the balls. I
by
said
the balls.
Balls. Not
yes.
even nuts.
Yes.
I think balls is worse.
So do we? You raise the question. you more than anyone else in the studio knows and probably associates with African leaders. So you tell me.
I think we're starting to cultivate that kind of leadership more and more in our countries, because we've had a few of them and we see that what they're doing is working. Mm. And practical and has impactful and positive results on their populations. So, and I also think that, you know, your average African is becoming more and more impatient with lazy, sloppy leadership and demanding change. Having said that, it's still a long process for a lot of our African counterparts. It's going to take time. But I think the seed has been planted and we're on the road to...
We're
quote
on the road, Mimi, but these leaders don't hold each other accountable. So,
that's the problem.
So how in the world is this thing going to move forward without stops and starts?
Well, I think that, you know, this is the thing also. The issue of leaders holding each other accountable, I think, is a valid one. Mm-hmm. But how do we hold our leaders accountable? We put them in office. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, the situation of South Africa, you know, how much are we doing to hold our leaders accountable in South Africa?
What more can we do?
You know,
I'm at a loss. No, trust me, this guy.
I put the question out there and then I take up my DRC flag and leave you to answer it.
Well, let's speak about the DRC then. What can you do about the DRC?
No, same situation. I completely agree with you. Is that, you know, what are we doing to hold our leaders accountable? There was an election that was supposed to happen in the DRC. It never happened.
There's no money.
You know, it got extended. There's no money, quote unquote. Where's the money? Show me the money.
Yeah.
Nowhere to be seen. So the issue of leaders holding each other accountable is one thing, but I think that perhaps, and I don't have the answer to this, there need to be better systems put in place for citizenry to hold their leaders accountable. Because ultimately, like we said, you know, these are all high-level thoughts. Mm. But to the person living in Kinshasa or in Katanga or wherever, you know, these are issues. You know, how do we help that person become more empowered to choose the kind of leadership that they need for their country?
But you see, that's where my challenge is if our leaders can't even manage a country. Mm. How in the world are they going to manage an integrated bloc where people are moving freely, trade and so on? If they are unable to, because then it requires a greater level of cooperation between the leaders, mm-hmm. which means holding each other to account. Because in some instances they have to share debt, right? They have to share currency obligations. There are a range of things that come about, and that's what we saw in Europe where it began to disintegrate was when some countries said, I'm not underwriting the debt of this country. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the unity there began to fall apart. But mm-hmm. that was probably like holding one another account. You have not been prudent in the way you manage your national accounts. Why must I now carry your debt? In the same way, but on the continent where we can't even make a phone call to one another to say, dude, What's going on?
Yeah.
We've got an opposition leader from South Africa that tried to go to Zambia and was summarily deported back into South Africa. Mm. And our government clearly thinks it's a joke. They don't say, hey, you know, just in terms, that should be that guy is a member of parliament. It should be a diplomatic crisis to say, how in the world do you deport one of our parliamentarians? Mm. So it's not happening at such a small scale. What is going, how do we, and at least how is the AU thinking about how we make sure that this thing happens without those accountability measures?
Mm. So is that an issue of the inherent current state, though? You know, so our leaders not holding each other to account because we're not integrated, because we don't have anything to hold each other to account for. Mm. So that's also a question that needs to be answered, because, you know, when you there's the issue of holding each other to account, but then there's also the issue of talking as one voice. And I think this is one of the key things of the reform as well, is to say, when we go and talk to the United Nations, for example, about the Chibok girls in Nigeria, we're going as a continent. It's not just Nigeria going to fight their own fights. So there's, you know, so I think that that starts to bring in an element of accountability on everybody's part, that X amount of girls in Nigeria cannot just go missing and it's just Nigeria's problem.
And
you
there's
know,
a possibility they've crossed borders.
And
as
there's
well,
a possibility
right?
they've crossed borders. And so how does everybody unite around this issue? One of the things that I like to ask people quite a lot is, do you think that the 1994 genocide in Rwanda would have happened if we were united as a continent? You know, would have Muammar Gaddafi been murdered in the way that he was on African soil if we were united as a continent? So these are the questions that we need to ask ourselves. And I think with every process comes accountability, as well as rights and responsibilities, right? It's an all-rounder.
So if you look at the Visa Openness Index that's produced by the African Development Bank, you see that the Seychelles is the most open African country at the moment. But what you see is some of the larger economies are not very open. South Africa performs pretty poorly there. Nigeria is also performing quite poorly there. Egypt is also not amongst the top countries. So these are the big economies. What is it going to take to convince? It almost feels like if you can't get these countries to play along, it creates, you know, it almost becomes difficult to make the real dream and the vision happen. Mm. What are the conversations that are happening to try and convince these large economies to do it, and where are they in terms of you know, closeness to being convinced?
Yeah, I think that the larger economies, you know, although they have questions and concerns about some of these reforms, a lot of them are actually really considering, you know, implementing them, and some of them already are. So let's take the example of South Africa. We were talking earlier about how South Africa is talking about having a visa-free policy, etc. These are conversations that are already happening at the Home Affairs level. So there are issues in terms of the technicalities. And this is important to say, is that the technicalities of how these reforms are implemented can be questioned and can be, perhaps, you know, massaged to fit certain criteria. But whether the reforms should be implemented is not even a question on any level.
Mm. And what do we do then about the countries that where there's a lot of, so let's say Somalia, for example, right? We don't really have a government there. Things are falling apart. How do those countries get integrated without opening up the risk of terrorism and so on? Because they're seen as a high terrorism risk. Mm-hmm. If we get to visa openness, it means that we could be allowing people in here that aren't even Somalians, not even Africans, who are coming in and causing that. What are the measures that can be put in place?
So I think that when we start talking about the issues of terrorism and looking at a country like Somalia, you know, often our narrative is still one of the other. Mm. Right. So
that's our problem.
Yeah, that's their problem. So let them sort it out. And once they've sorted it out, then they can become integrated with the rest of us good people. Mm. The issues in Somalia are everybody's problem. Again, going back to an example with the Chibok girls. Mm. So what's happening in Somalia is not just a Somalian problem. How do we make it an African problem and all contribute to the resolution? And make terrorism, because terrorism is not just happening in Nigeria and Somalia and all of these places. You know, sooner or later, it's going to filter down to the rest of us.
It's actually interesting because it probably already has. The terrorists are probably more regionally integrated than the formal economy.
Than the rest
right?
of us,
yeah,
yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Because they move arms and money and all of that. They've figured it out and we're still bumbling around.
Absolutely. It's an African problem, and more importantly, it's a world problem. But it's an African problem in our context.
But we've got Africa peacekeeping missions and so on. Why are those not working? Because at that level, we're treating it as though it is an Africa problem, but it seems it doesn't seem to be working.
Yeah, I think that in terms of the peacekeeping missions, there's obviously an issue of funding. There's an issue of, you know, it's funny, the when I say narrative, and I hate to repeat myself on this issue, but the whole other versus us, you know, we put together a peacekeeping force, but how many of our African countries are actually actively participating in keeping those peacekeeping forces working, agile, effective, and efficient, you know? So once we take Africa's peace and security as everybody's problem, and that's one of the reforms that we're talking about with the African Union, that was proposed and accepted, then we can, you know, then it can become a reality for all of us.
It's quite interesting because we speak of this thing called Africa and it's huge and so on, but there's also regional economic blocks, right? Mm-hmm. You've got ECOWAS, you've got the EAC, UMA, SADC, and so on. But it's quite interesting to note that out of all of these different trading blocks or regional trading blocks on the continent, there are only two that have 100% reciprocal visa arrangements between those countries. Mm-hmm. In other words, the people in those economic blocks can move around visa-free. But even in individual sort of regional blocks, I mean, in SADC, it's a 52% reciprocity between the different countries, UMA, it's only two regions. So if we're not winning in terms of just getting it right at a regional level, what is it going to take to get it to an African level? Do you know of why these regions are still struggling?
I don't know, and I don't know the stats and the facts behind that. Mm. But Rory, let me ask this question. Is, first of all, what do we have to lose? Right? That is really the bigger question here. Mm. What do we have to lose if we integrate? What are we getting so right? Because, you know, you're pointing out a lot of things that we're getting wrong. Mm. So if we're getting those things wrong, would trying something different be so completely off our radar and not work that before we even try it, that we're not willing to even give it a try? So what I'm saying is, you know, let's not necessarily focus on what's not working, because we know that what's not working has not been working for years. We've tried so many different solutions. How will it affect us if we tried something different?
Firm reprimand there delivered to me. So you tell me, how do I get involved? What are the ways in which I get involved in making sure that we advance this agenda? What are next steps as far as the African passport is concerned? Where to now?
So one of the biggest, you know, issues that I'm dealing with, you know, from a professional point of view and also as an African, is just communicating about these reforms. And there's a huge level of education that needs to go into it. You know, like you said, you know, not only does the ordinary African not necessarily know about these reforms that are taking place at the AU level, but a lot of them don't even understand what the AU is, what it was originally, you know, what was the institution at the beginning? Why was it formed? What it achieved up to this point? And what are the next steps and how these reforms are going to affect our everyday lives? Mm. And I think that, you know, Africans becoming more informed is one of our biggest challenges, because we don't necessarily always show the interest, right?
Yeah.
And I think once you become interested in issues that are going to so impact your life so definitively, as free trade, as peace and security, as having one African passport, as opening up borders, then, you know, then you can become a part of the solution and, you know, contribute to the conversation. And I think secondly is to also, you know, get Africans more motivated and incentivized to push their leaders for change. You know, going back to my earlier point, pushing our leadership to really take the necessary steps towards our quote unquote emancipation.
And the African passport, how is it going to be rolled out? I believe that some people already have an Africa passport, or is that so? So
some people already do,
yes.
At very high levels. So certain presidents, etc. But like I said, I think that the infrastructure at country level needs to be implemented before it's actually rolled out to, you know, ordinary citizens like you and I.
And you, as somebody who travels widely on the continent, give a sense to those of us that probably don't travel enough on the continent around. What are we missing out on? Because maybe that's what people really struggle to grasp. It's easier when you've moved around, you see what's on the continent. Mm. What exactly are we missing on a person level? So not what's good for the continent, but on an individual level.
I think on an individual level, the first thing is many of the stereotypes you have as an African about Africa are completely untrue. They're just that, stereotypes. So, you know, when you say that we have, you know, there's so much poverty in Mali that, you know, most Malians will want to move to South Africa, go to Mali and find out, you know, what there is there.
Ignorance, Rory. Ignorance.
I didn't say it. You said it. You said it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Mimi, for joining me as co-guest host.
Thank you.
I think we're going to make this a regular. We're seeing a lot of people clapping their hands and saying, go, Mimi, the Mimi magic. thank you very much for joining us. I think this is a conversation that we need to have. But for everyone out there, guys, let's jump in. I think the first thing is let's start moving around. You can't have toured Europe or the U.S. more broadly than you've toured the country next door. So,
absolutely.
So let's jump in there and let's make sure that we get to know our continent. From me, I'm out. We'll see you again next week. CliffCentral.com.